Hello, everyone. I'm Jim Paymar, and you are listening to The Big Shift, the podcast that looks at the seismic changes our world and our country confront. Today, we're investigating a topic that we all need to survive, water. Without water, there would be no plant life, no forests, crops could not grow, livestock could not exist, so we'd have nothing to eat. And the fact of the matter is, we as people consist of water. The average adult human body is about 60% water. Tragically, the world, with some 8 billion people growing to 10 billion by the year 2050, is running out of water as we heat the planet to such an extent that glaciers and snowpack that feed mountain streams disappear. We are draining groundwater from aquifers to the point of no return. And we pollute sources of clean drinking water by using rivers and lakes as virtual industrial and residential sewers. To discuss this vital issue impacting all our lives is Adrian Esposito, co-founder and executive director of the Citizens Campaign for the Environment based in New York. Adrian has been a longtime champion of water protection, public health, preventing pesticide use, ending plastic pollution, and creating alternative energy sources. Adrian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Jim. I'm happy to be here.
You know, Adrian, we seem to be in the midst of a global water crisis. Back in 1995, the vice president of the World Bank said, if the wars of the last century were fought over oil, the wars of the next century will be fought over water unless we change our approach to managing this precious and vital resource. His premonition nearly 30 years ago seems to be pretty correct, Adrian.
Unfortunately, I have to agree with him. Water wars are already starting to happen here and there. As water dwindles, we will have more conflict and more stress about how to keep and manage the current water supply we have. And it's going to be tricky, Jim.
That indeed, because you've got nations fighting over water already and diverting rivers, et cetera. Droughts seem to be striking in every region of the world. By 2025, according to the UN, they predict that two-thirds of the global population will live in water-scarce areas. More than 2.3 billion people face water stress today, and almost 160 million children are exposed to severe and prolonged droughts. And what is the path forward with record-shattering heat becoming worse and worse every year?
Well, we have to fight climate change. This is as a direct result of population increase and climate change. And we have yet to really address it as a globe and as a global community and also as a nation. But, you know, we have to do two things at the same time. We have to fight climate change, but we also have to look at our water resources and figure out how to manage them wisely and a more sustainable way. Let's just look at groundwater. I don't know if folks out there have read the New York Times report that just came out a couple of weeks ago, but it was pretty alarming. The New York Times assessed 80,000 wells, public supply wells, and wells for farming across America, and found that 45% of those wells showed a statistically significant decline in water levels since 1980. Mm-hmm. That, and the worst of it really occurred over the last few years, which means we are really withdrawing our aquifers or groundwater quicker and quicker. And that is not sustainable. It took decades, and in some cases, 100 or 200 years or even more for the aquifers to fill up. And yet we are depleting them in a minuscule amount of time.
The main cause of a groundwater depletion, as you say, is we're sucking the water out of the ground so fast, we're pumping it out. What do we do with the system that we've already put in place? Our agricultural industries depend on it.
Well, it's two things. It's called groundwater mining, which means simply, as you just said wisely, we're taking more water out of the ground than the rain is able to replace naturally, which means we're running a deficit. And it's like your bank account. If you don't put the money in, at some point, you can't take any more out. So what happens is that we now have established a system for agriculture, but not just agriculture, for the population, recreational use. Those are the three biggest draws on the water system. And what we have is like we don't have any planning. And we have an agricultural system that's demanding more and more. We have crops being grown in desert conditions. We have people moving into the desert who want more and more water. We have industry and commercial areas in water depleted areas, which means we're using these aquifer systems. We can do things like better planning, management of groundwater. Right now, there's no laws really to speak of, or if there are, they are too weak, which govern the withdrawal of groundwater. It wasn't really a resource, I think, that some entities thought would have to be managed. Unfortunately, they thought it would last forever. And now we know it's not an infinite resource. It's a finite resource.
Then there's the issue of, you know, these massive dams that we've built, not only in this country, but all around the world, irrigation projects that divert water from where it would naturally flow. For example, 40 million people in 7 states here in the U.S. and 2 states in Mexico are dependent on the mighty Colorado River. It irrigates 15% of America's agriculture and about 90% of the nation's winter vegetables. And the river is drying up rapidly, which will directly affect life all across the Southwest and for America as a whole. And yet more and more people, as you said, are moving into these regions and they're demanding more water.
Yes. And it doesn't stop there. And I don't want to be the bearer of even more bad news, but let's look at the Great Lakes. The Great Lakes hold 20% of the Earth's fresh water supply. And yet we use those Great Lakes for industrial dumping, sewage treatment dumping, and we also use them as a drinking water source. So the bottom line here is the water management policies of 50 years ago are not relevant to today's demands and today's conditions. And so we need as a nation to revamp them. We need to implement, and there are answers. This is not about just, you know, we have a crisis, which we do, but there are solutions. We have to talk about water efficiency, water conservation. There are lots of water reuse plans that are now being looked at that we need to just employ and put into action. There are things we can do that would satisfy the water demands, but reduce consumption as well. And technology is coming along with that. I mean, we can treat water now to a fairly good level, but we have to then reuse it. We cannot look at water as a waste product anymore. We have to look at it as the very important, critical natural resource that it actually is.
Well, we have to recycle it and reclaim it and put it into a natural use so that we can actually drink it, use it for all our needs in our homes and industry and not be dumping it into fresh water supplies.
Exactly. I mean, I know a lot of projects that, for instance, we're working on is reuse of water that has been treated. So it's treated effluent water, but it can be used to water golf courses, for instance. Why are we using, you know, pure, pristine groundwater or even surface water to water a golf course? We can reuse water for that kind of a purpose. We can reuse, it's called gray water, for some systems like power plants that when they need a cooling system, or car washes, for instance, or other uses such as that. So there are a lot of opportunities out there where we can reuse water that's been treated without just discharging it or without just treating it as a waste product.
You mentioned the Great Lakes, and what we're talking about is happening all around the world. And there was an article not too long ago about the Aral Sea, which is really a big, big lake, larger than Lake Michigan, which is one of our biggest Great Lakes. And it's basically been turned into a desert because the Russians have diverted rivers flowing into it. I know we have no control over the Russians, but certainly international bodies should be able to preserve water for population centers that depend on it. The whole fishing industry died around the Aral Sea. People had to move away. There's nothing there anymore except a bunch of ships sitting on the ground because there's no water in the lake.
It's crazy, right? I mean, actually, a good example of that where the opposite happens is the Great Lakes again, but it's shared water bodies between Canada and the U.S., two different nations. But yet they put together what's called the IJC, the International Joint Commission. Believe it or not, that was established in 1909.
Where
they said, yeah, it's the International Boundaries Water Treaties. And what they said is we have this shared water resource. We need to treat it as a resource for both of our countries. And we're going to manage it collaboratively and together. And so that treaty's been in place. This commission's been in place. And they create the policy policies that govern the Great Lakes. It's a little more complicated than that, but yet it's a good example of a partnership and how we have to treat these regional assets.
Okay, but you're talking about the United States and Canada. We have a pretty good we have a pretty good relationship with the Canadians. But when you start getting into other parts of the world, like the Ganges in India, and you get into Russia, and you get into Africa, look what they're doing. They're damming up the Nile River so that the Egyptians are very concerned about that.
I mean, well, as they should be.
Yeah, I mean that's how their food is grown, and they've got a huge population and growing. Are there international bodies that can somehow protect us from the UN? We just came through COP28, which is, you know, the climate change conference that is held every year. But where are the authorities? Where is the enforcement to stop us from what you mentioned earlier was the climate change component, but also when it comes to sharing the water resource?
You know, Jim, it's interesting because there isn't any kind of global overall review of that. And we don't really have it a national one here in America. I mean, again, I just want to go back to the New York Times assessment. Mm-hmm. They had to do their own individual assessment of those 80,000 wells because there's no one entity here in America that does it. Some of the wells are governed by individual water districts. Some of them are governed by local municipalities. Some of them are governed by the state. So they had to assess a myriad of different databases, different local, state, and federal agencies' databases just to compile the information about how the wells are doing. Mm-hmm. And so we've treated our water resource in America as it's treated globally in a very fractured, piecemeal way where we're not getting a cohesive picture. And when you don't have a cohesive picture, you cannot get a cohesive policy that will be successful in protecting the resource. So it comes from first starting to understand this is a collective resource. And I think that if we tried to do something on a global scale, it might be a little bit different than climate change. Because climate change is something where, you know, some of the countries, some of them still don't believe it, some of them, but water, it's pretty quantifiable when you look out the window and the lake is dry. It's kind of hard to argue that there's a water issue going on.
You can see it.
You can see it. You understand it. It's a necessity. This is not a luxury item. And we need to do better. We can do better, but we got to get to it.
Talking about that issue, who protects our water here in the United States? According to the CDC, the United States has one of the safest drinking water systems in the world, but we rank 23rd. And that doesn't seem so great for the technological marvel America is said to be.
Look, we have the United States EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, establishes some of the standards, like, for instance, our drinking water standards. So we have a myriad of standards for volatile organic chemicals, heavy metals, pesticides, but we have a lot more to go. So for instance, we have been waiting and waiting for the EPA to finally mandate a drinking water standard for an emerging contaminant that many have heard about called PFAS chemicals. And this chemical is so toxic, Jim, that the standard, for instance, in New York State is 10 parts per trillion. And last year, the EPA came out with a recommended standard, hold on to your chair, of under 1 parts per trillion, under 1, which basically means parts per trillion, just want everyone to know, PPT. That is a very small amount. That virtually means that no exposure to this toxic chemical is safe. And yet, in America, we have not yet adopted a drinking water standard for this chemical. And there are people out there right now across America, drinking this toxic chemical that is known to have such effects of cancer to the thyroid, the liver, the pancreas, reproductive problems, immune system problems, low birth weight, and other issues. You know, we need to kind of have the EPA quicken their pace a little bit to provide those drinking water standards to keep America safe and healthy.
But what chemical is that again?
PFAS, PFAS.
Not to delve too much into our supercharged election this November, but ex-President Trump has stated numerous times if he's elected, he's going to go drill, 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 baby, for oil and natural gas, open up federal lands to mining projects. Wouldn't this reverse the progress we've made in America to reduce our carbon footprint?
Yes. Let me say this. Look, our organization, we're nonpartisan. We actually have a very strong history of working with Republicans and working with Democrats. Mm-hmm. Staunch Republicans and staunch Democrats. But frankly, we don't care. We don't care who you are, what your political affiliation is. What we care about is clean water and public health protection. So when I answer this question, I'll tell you, yes, going back to drill, drill, drill is not the answer. The more climate change fuel we have in the atmosphere, the more droughts we're going to have, the less drinking water we're going to have, the less stable we are as Americans. We need clean water to protect public health. We need it to grow our food. We need it for our recreational industry. It will affect our economy. And let me tell you something, filtering toxic drinking water is not cheap. Mm-hmm. These new emerging contaminants like PFAS and 1,4-dioxane, they're very costly to filter. Who pays?
Drinking the taxpayer, water, us.
Exactly. So we have to look differently. We can't just go back to the past to prepare us for a future that has many pitfalls. We can do better. We can have a plan. This is not rocket science, to be honest with you, but it really is accepting that we need to change and we need to have a sustainability plan and we need to have a plan that fights climate change because it's directly related to drinking water quality and quantity.
But you mentioned the EPA just a moment ago.
Yes.
And if, again, going back to the Trump era, they tried to dismantle the EPA. They put people in charge of it that weren't going to protect our water rights and to enforce environmental protections. We don't want to be going backwards. We need to be going forwards. And how do we maintain the progress that we've made, in fact, make more progress in the future?
This is a great question, Jim. I'm glad you asked this. Yes, and I remember that because I was there. We were on the battle lines during that EPA debacle. We have to stop this nonsense concept that regulations hurt businesses and regulations are bad for America and regulations cause people unemployed. Baloney. I'm calling BS on that because clean water helps America. Not paying to filter our water helps America. Clean water, every industry also has a responsibility to every American to protect these natural resources and do good business. We can do both. We can have good businesses, we can have thriving businesses, and we can have clean water when businesses understand they also are stewards of this resource. They are partners with us. You don't get to dump in our water, pollute, and walk away. This is not the Industrial Revolution anymore. We're in the new millennium. We're in the year 2024. Industry, and many of them have, many industries don't want to go back to those old polluting ways. Many industries want to do the right thing. And when there's regulations, those industries feel that levels the playing field. So even the bad industries that want to pollute now have to live up to higher standards. The higher standards lift us all up. Mm-hmm. It may cost industry a little more, but you know what costs more, Jim? Cancer costs more. So let's stop pretending that environmental regulations are bad for America, because environmental regulations are good for America. They're good for the public, good for our health, and good for our economy.
No, I'm just wondering, Adrienne, if anyone has ever done a calculation on what it has cost American taxpayers just to clean up Superfund sites all across this country.
That's really a good question, Jim. I don't know the answer.
It's got to be in the tens of hundreds of billions of dollars.
Absolutely. I mean, I serve on a couple of different advisory boards. One, we're cleaning up a plume left over by the Navy and Grumman. It's millions and millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And the more they examine the plume, the more they're finding. You know? And that's just one small, relatively Superfund site in Suffolk County, Long Island. It's a Cavalton Navy Grumman plume. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right. It's so cost prohibitive. And the better answer is prevent the contamination, save taxpayer dollars, but also save the public's health and save drinking water.
And it takes decades to clean these things up.
Oh my God. And then do you really clean them up? They still leave residual toxins.
Once you've got water from above, from the skies, hitting that pollutant, it goes down into the aquifers. How are you supposed to ever clean it up?
it becomes more expensive and more costly each year that goes by. Because with toxic waste in a Superfund site, every time it rains, those toxics travel in the soil. Mm-hmm. They come out sometimes in rivers and streams. Or if you have a groundwater system, they will travel down further into that groundwater and will travel in the direction wherever there's a river and a stream and a lake for them to travel out.
And it could travel thousands of miles too, right? I mean,
it depends on
look at our river system.
Well, they could travel hundreds of miles underground, but then they eventually reach an output part, which means it's either a stream or a pond or, you know, the ocean or an estuary system.
America suffers from widespread industrial pollution, sewage contamination, poor land management programs that lead to toxic fertilizer being released into our rivers, our lakes, and our oceans. Why isn't there greater enforcement by federal and state governments to reduce pollution? For example, we live in New York. I've lived in California. I've lived in Washington. Does each state have an authority, or are we all beholden to the federal government on this?
Another good question. Each state has their own environmental agency. They can have stricter standards than the federal government, but they cannot have more lenient standards than the federal government. So for instance, if the federal government, you know, ever decides to have a drinking water standard for PFAS at, you know, 0.04 parts per trillion, then every state needs to comply with that standard. Mm-hmm. They cannot have a standard that's above that. So each state has their own agency. Some of the agencies are lax and some of them are not. And that's, as I said, we treat these environmental resources in a very fragmented fashion.
Mining, which we kind of touched on, also affects fresh water through heavy use of water and processing ore and through water pollution from discharged mining effluent and seepage from tailings and waste rock. Increasingly, mining threatens the water sources on which we all depend. But we need these raw materials, right, Adrian, to make everything that we use in our lives. So how do we protect our water resources and at the same time mine for the materials that we need in our cars and our computers and our TVs?
Well, this is an example of better standards. I mean, you're right. And look, we're not a pie in the sky organization here. We understand people have needs. You know, we're not going to live in a pristine world. I wish that we could, but we won't. That's the reality. And mining is going to be part of life, but it has to be done in the most environmentally sensitive way. And with some of the new technologies, actually, they can do some less damage in some of the mining methodologies. But you know what? Can we just go back to sewage for a second?
Sure.
Because there might not be mining in every state, but there certainly is wastewater disposal in every state.
True.
And so one of the challenges is money. We know how to treat sewage. The technology has really come a long way, but we haven't really invested as a nation as we should in upgrading, expanding, and updating our sewer infrastructure. Recently, through the Federal Infrastructure Act, money has been allocated, and that's been groups all over the nation have been going to Washington, D.C. year after year after year, lobbying for please, please, money in the budget for sewer infrastructure upgrades and expanding sewers into areas that are still using the archaic and antiquated septic and cesspool systems. So even though we act like we're so sophisticated here in the U.S., our wastewater systems are not sophisticated. In fact, in many, many cities, the pipes are 100 years old. Mm. They're cracking, they're crumbling. I just came from a meeting this morning. One county just did an assessment, and to upgrade their sewer infrastructure, just the underground pipe, $200 million.
We could spend billions and billions to really rebuild our systems. And that's a concern, again, because if the political environment turns in 2025, if there's a change in administrations, are we going to see a drawback of our efforts to rebuild infrastructure?
That's a great question. But you know what? Let me just point this out. I think it's important. If we put funding into rebuilding that kind of infrastructure, water infrastructure, we create jobs, mm-hmm. good paying jobs, plumbing jobs, engineering jobs, electrical jobs. We create these, we call them green jobs, but they're just regular jobs. And we create a wonderful, good economy where men and women are put to work in jobs that are sustainable and make good wages, and we're upgrading our infrastructure. We all need to treat our sewage. This is not a Republican or a Democratic issue. Mm-hmm. It's a human issue. And that's another example of how we have to stop thinking that this is a political issue, as some elected officials unfortunately do, and really understand it's an issue that benefits everybody equally.
Well, beyond creating jobs and a new economy, not a new economy, but an economy that grows and prospers, you're also not going to be spending money on cleanup.
Very good point.
Which is a waste. It's just a waste of money.
You're exactly right. As we said earlier, the filtration devices is for the PFAS chemical we're talking about. Fortunately, you can clean that up out of drinking water. It's an activated carbon filtration system, but there's still about $1 million per water supply well. And then you have to pay to maintain the system. So the best thing to do is prevent that contaminant from getting into the drinking water. And you're absolutely right. You save money for taxpayers, save the public health, you accomplish those two critical goals that people like and need by prevention.
Adrian, another issue confronting us is our coastal waters. Rising sea levels caused by global warming is a problem. During storm surges and high tides, salt water is encroaching into wetlands, basically destroying them. I mean, people talk about global warming. I like to use the term global broiling as we set new global temperature records every year. But extreme heat is severely harming our wetlands, which actually clean water, recharge water supplies, and improve water quality. So destroying wetlands changes native species, and it also introduces non-native species, another losing battle, it seems.
100%, Jim. And I just had this conversation with a wetlands scientist this morning who evaluated some wetlands on the south shore of Long Island, who said the wetlands are now so inundated with salt water that so quickly, because of rising sea levels and these storms that we just keep getting in rapid succession, they're not able to adapt quick enough to the rising sea level, and they're becoming non-functional. Mm-hmm. And by non-functional, I mean they're not going to be able to protect us from storms. They're not going to be able to protect us from tidal surges. They're not going to be able to protect us from localized flooding. And we know if it's happening here, it's happening in other coastal communities across America.
And so, across the world.
Yes, thank you. And you know what? 50% of America's population lives around the coastal communities.
Mm-hmm.
So again, this is an economic issue. It's a safety issue. It's a protection of life issue, not a Democratic issue, not a Republican issue, but one that protects us all by protecting the wetlands and fighting against sea level rise. We protect everybody.
And for those of us who love seafood and oysters and clams and everything else that comes from the sea, we have to protect it.
Yes, I agree. I'm all in. I grew up with 1 foot in the water and 1 foot on the land and a fishing pole in one hand and a crab trap in the other. And I think every kid should grow up that way, frankly. But some people are afraid to bring their kids to the beach now because the water's so brown.
It's just awful. Invasive species are causing massive damage to major rivers and to the oceans. We've seen massive algae blooms caused by pollutants in major lakes, rivers, and in our oceans. And the problem seems to be getting much, much worse as the climate warms. Do you hold out much hope for reversing the trend?
Well, what we're finding with these toxic algal blooms is that they're being fed by nitrogen and phosphates. And the nitrogen are coming from poorly treated or untreated sewage, and in some cases from fertilizer runoff from farmlands. But in most cases that I've studied, it's because there are no sewers in an area. There's these communities, let's just take, Cape Cod, Newport, Rhode Island, Suffolk County, Long Island. They are using septic and cesspool systems, leaching out barely treated sewage right into the estuary systems, or in some cases, the lakes. That's fueling these algal blooms in combination with warmer waters. And that has resulted in blue-green algae in freshwater, mm-hmm. which is very toxic. It's already killed dogs across America who've gone in these fresh lakes because it attacks the liver. Mm-hmm. It's fueled red tide and brown tide and mahogany tide. And these tides can be very serious. Red tide is what's called a saxotoxin, which unfortunately means that it can cause paralysis or death if it builds up in shellfish and we eat those shellfish. So these toxic tides, as they're called, are very serious. They are being studied, but we need, again, this goes back to needing to treat our sewage and not using our waterways as a toilet.
It's so obnoxious. I was born and raised in Minnesota, and they have a terrible situation going on because it's an agricultural state, and the fertilizer runoff from the farms into the streams, into the aquifers, is causing huge pollution problems. And then Minnesota is not alone. All the Great Plains states have the same situation.
You're absolutely right. So, in the past, we didn't know that, right? This is science. It's showing us new causes for new impacts. But now we know. And the more we know, the better we should do. We have to stop rejecting science in this nation and start introducing good science and creating good policy with some good common sense. And we can move forward in that way.
Is there enough political will? Do people really care about this issue enough to push their legislators to take action before it's too late? Because once you polluted the streams and the aquifers and the oceans, you can't heal it overnight. You can't cure it overnight.
But you can heal it. You can heal it. You can cure it. And to answer your question, I've been doing this work, I guess I'll just admit it, over 30 years.
Wow.
And you know what? People do care about clean water over and over and over. We still do community meetings. I go to the legislature constantly. People do care. But We must provide people not only an analysis of the problem, but the solution. And that solution, as I said earlier, must be based on good science, good common sense, because that will yield good policy. And our elected officials, I don't expect them to be knowledgeable on every subject that they have to tackle. Mm-hmm. So it's the advocates, frankly, that bring these issues to elected officials so that they can act. And we've been doing that. We're going to continue to do that. We believe 1,000% we have the public support in every poll ever taken. People feel clean water is one of the primary things that they care about, that they want, and that they deserve. And we agree with them. They're absolutely right.
Another issue that we've been learning a lot about lately is the devastating impact of plastic pollution, and especially in our oceans. It seems like plastics are literally everywhere today, from containers, wrapping of products, grocery bags, utensils, our garbage pails, even our cars. Plastic pollution, it seems, poses us a really serious threat to all life because the chemicals used during the production process are toxic. And plastics are able to enter into the human bloodstream, permanently staying in our bodies until the day we die. Is there any way to turn this around?
Well, plastic pollution is another big challenge. It's, as you said earlier, a global challenge. And yes, we can use less plastic or eliminate plastic.
Your toothpaste container, your printer, your telephone. I'm just looking around my office. I mean, there's plastic everywhere.
Yeah, but you know what I would say, honestly, we're not getting plastic in the drinking water from the printer, for instance, or the toothpaste. What it's coming from is this myriad of single-use plastic, as it's called, these plastic water bottles, which we don't. Listen, that's an easy fix, right? Get a stainless steel water bottle. You go to any fair and they're giving away for nothing. We can stop using plastic bags. You know, New York banned plastic bags, and we've saved billions and billions and billions of plastic bags. Single-use ones like the utensils. We can tackle single-use plastic first, and I think that is more than doable. It's just changing habits and changing the mindset, and then tackle the bigger plastic issues. We can reduce plastic packaging. We can make plastic more recyclable instead of using these ridiculous different, we have 7 different types of plastic right now in products, and not all of it is even recyclable.
What about all the chemicals that are used in making my printer? Making the plastic also is toxic to the environment.
I agree, Jim, but one step at a time. So right now for us, the low-hanging fruit in the plastic battle would be single-use plastic. The second one is to reduce plastic and packaging. And the third one is to increase the recycling of plastic to prevent or to reduce new plastic from being created. There's some answers. I don't think anybody has all the answers.
Right.
But there are steps we can do to move us forward in the right direction.
But what do you do about countries, let's say over in Asia, where plastic bags are just flowing in the rivers and then washing up on shore once they get into the oceans and the tides push them back in and the fish are eating them and dying. It seems to be an insurmountable problem right now.
Well, to be honest with you, I don't have any answers for Asia's policies. I can only say that the United States should lead by example, and we can have policies here that set the example and set the standard.
I know you're a big proponent of alternative energy so that we can reduce the amount of greenhouse gas we emit into the atmosphere due to the burning of fossil fuels in our cars, planes, and power plants. How much progress do you believe we are making on that front?
We are making progress. Is it quick enough? No. Is it enough? No. But it is progress nonetheless. In America, we now have two offshore wind farms. Mm-hmm. And the first one was off of Block Island. And that is a small one. It's just for Block Island. It's 5 turbines, 6 megawatts each, which is 30 megawatts. And that powers Block Island. We also have off of Long Island in New York, the South Fork Wind Farm. It's half of the turbines are in. The rest of them will be done in just a few short weeks, sometime in February or March of 2024. And that's going to pump clean electric into the South Fork of Long Island. Mm-hmm. And that's the first offshore wind farm in New York. And there's more and more being permitted and selected along the East Coast for New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts.
Lots of offshore projects that are in the works, but the big projects are on land in places like Texas, places like North Dakota, and where you've got a tremendous wind power, and that also is creating a lot of electricity.
Yeah, I mean, this is the irony. We have some Republican conservatives who are saying, we don't need wind, and yet we have Texas. Texas mm-hmm. is the number one state in the nation for wind power production. I mean, they got the memo, right? Wind
right.
works, you know, it creates jobs. You know, we call it the windustry.
Right.
Because it's creating a new industry of, again, high-tech jobs in all sorts of areas of technology and trades that create good jobs. It's a great industry. Let's do it.
And you're seeing big oil get into this business, too, both in terms of wind power and electric vehicles and battery production. I mean, there are options. And I think people are seeing that if we don't do something about climate change, it's going to be very destructive to our entire existence.
And Jim, even if you're one of those climate deniers because you got your head stuck in the hot sand, you have to say to yourself, well, it's still good to diversify our energy generation sources, right? Mm-hmm. It's still good. So let's do wind. Let's do solar. We're probably not going to wean ourselves off oil and natural gas for quite a while, but solar and wind, particularly solar during the hot seasons, wind during other seasons, they generate electricity. So we've become less reliant on oil and natural gas. We've diversified the energy sources. That's a good thing. Why would you ever fight against that? It doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't. But one issue regarding solar power and wind power is that electricity needs to be transported. And we do not have efficient power grids in this country to transport electricity, put it in the Mojave Desert, for example, but do you have the electrical plan to bring it to Los Angeles, or if you're in Texas, to bring it to Houston and Dallas?
Well, we need to modernize our grid. You know, it's the year 2024. We can't use the same grid that we used 60 years ago. So again, that's another thing. So we'll modernize the grid. We'll have to put money into it. It creates jobs. To say we can't advance technologically because we want to use the same old grid that we've been using for 70 or 80 years is probably not someone who's thinking about the best of America to come. It's someone who wants to stay stuck in the past. So you're right. We do absolutely need to modernize our grid. But again, we know how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing it. We're doing it where I live on Long Island. We're mm-hmm. doing it in other areas. That's a technological fix. And we need political will to do it. But we do know how to do it. And usually that's the hard part, is understanding how to do it. And that we have.
Political will. And also, if you could get corporations behind this, if it created profits for shareholders, they would get behind it. So there's got to be a financial solution to this as well as the political will.
Well, and I think that there is. I mean, that's why big oil is now investing in things like wind turbines and creating the blades and, you know, investing in the technology because they also see the writing on the wall. Oil is a finite resource. I know that makes some people angry and they think, no, there's plenty of oil. Plenty of oil for you in your lifetime. But some of us have to think about the next generation and the next ones to come. I think the oil industries are saying, hey, we diversify our portfolio. Oil will last longer. Let's make a smart business decision.
Right. And like I said at the beginning, you know, we're 8 billion people today growing to 10 billion. That's 2 billion more in the next 26 years, 2050. The oil that's in the ground now is going to be sucked out of a lot of these countries. That's why countries like in the OPEC theater, you know, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Bahrain, they're diversifying into solar and wind, and they realize that their resources are not going to last forever either.
That's a very good point. I mean, look, this is, we're in a new world. We have to have new answers for our new challenges, and solar and wind are part of those answers. I'm not saying, people say to me all the time, well, we can't rely on, I'm not saying it's the one answer. This is a puzzle piece, right? These are significant pieces of those puzzles. We need to develop and grow and use them. Some people have said, oh my God, they're going to cost money. As if staying addicted to oil and natural gas has been cheap for us. I don't get their, you know, concern. Oil and natural gas has done nothing but go up in price. Mm-hmm. That's why our electricity has gone up in price.
Well, hopefully we can turn that around, Adrian. And I know we've covered a lot of ground today,
but I'm
just wondering if you have anything you'd like to add to the discussion before we close it out.
Well, just in summary, I would like to say that I really, after doing this for so long in so many areas, believe the vast majority of the public would embrace the changes needed to protect their drinking water, protect their coastal water, their local lake, river, and stream, and also to embrace new renewable energy technologies so we can have cleaner air and fight climate change. The public supports these changes. And what we need to do is take that support, put it back into the ears of the elected officials so that policies can be crafted, created, passed, and implemented to have a stronger, safer, healthier America that's more livable, more sustainable, and more lovable for the future.
Sounds good to me, Adrian. I love that thought. If only we could get there sooner rather than later. We are out of time. Hopefully, we'll revisit this critical issue of water and the environment. It impacts all of us in the future. Thanks so much for joining us today. You're very insightful.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that was Adrian Esposito, co-founder and executive director of the Citizens Campaign for the Environment based in New York. If you want to learn more or get involved, go to their website. It's www.citizenscampaign.org. I'm Jim Paymar, and you've been listening to The Big Shift, available wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening today, and stay tuned for the next episode of The Big Shift. It's coming soon.